Good evening. It's a blessing to be here with you. Kevin, Mom, what are you doing here? I did not know they were coming. God bless you all. Good to see you. It's been difficult to prepare for this evening, but I'm honored to share, and I pray that somehow you all can be encouraged as well. And I want to be faithful to what I believe God has laid on my heart to share this evening. So maybe as way of introduction, to scratch the Freundschaft itch just a little bit, my grandma used to come here, Elsie Kaufman. Does anybody know Elsie Kaufman? All right, so a few people, I thought that might ring a few bells. I never expected to be here with at the same place she used to come, but it's great to be her grandson, and she's still living. I think she was a widow for over 60 years. My wife was Rachel Petersheim, and I just discovered when I got up here that her mom is here tonight, so that's such a blessing to see her from Oakland, Maryland. And we were married for 17 years. In the fall of 2020, we were married. She was killed at age 42. Just after our 17th anniversary in November 10 of 2020. So she was the daughter of Paul and Naomi Petersheim from Oakland, Maryland, who have also been here numerous times with the Handicap Seminar. Some of you might know them through that. Rachel and I lived in Leon, Iowa for about 3.5 years after we were married. That's where I was born and raised. And currently, I work at Bald Eagle Boys Camp. That's a camp for emotionally handicapped boys. I went there as a supervisor in 2007, and I've been program director now for the last 13 years. I have 4 children. They were pretty much born and raised at camp. That's all they know. My oldest is 17, Josiah, Clarita is 16, Hans 14, and Caitlin is 8. And I also have a special needs son, Hans, and maybe just a little more about him later. So the topic that I've been given is experiencing grace in the face of traumatic loss. And I thought maybe looking at that maybe in reverse a little bit, I'd like to just talk about loss and death a little bit and how it affects us universally, how it has affected this group of people, and then maybe look a little bit at the story, briefly at what happened in Rachel's case, in our family's case, the accident, and then end with grace and what we've experienced in our journey as a family. I know parts of it will be difficult, but just pray that I could be able to share in a way that's clear and straightforward. I'm still on a journey of wrestling with this. I'd like to think it gets easier with time, and I know some of you have been here many years, and when I came the first time, I didn't want to be here, and maybe those of you who are here for the first time identify with that. You didn't really want to be here. Maybe somebody drug you here. Somebody encouraged you to come. I was encouraged to come, and when I got here, I walked in the back, and there was a lot of laughing and talking. It looked like the ladies' day out. And I thought, wow, they're having fun. And I wasn't, but I was kind of encouraged to see a group of people having a good time. I was still wrestling with being a widower. I didn't like that. I didn't like that terminology. I was 5 months into it. And I'm not sure if anybody ever really likes that, but it's a reality, and it's a reality I've had to face, like it or not. And coming here was a piece of, I think, beginning the healing as well. I'm still wrestling with God on many things. My theology is not completely solid, probably, as probably none of ours is. But I work hard to be honest with myself, with God, and with other people around me as they also journey through difficult times. When I came here in 21, I came here mainly to see Yuri Sharp, And it was a blessing to come and visit with him. Our paths had crossed at SMBI, and so he's probably the reason that I came to start with. And I've been coming a little bit every year since then. So today I can say that it's good to be with you. I know here that the deepest feelings of grief are understood. I don't have to explain to you what it feels like to have your gut wrenched out. I don't have to explain to you the desperation of loss, the feeling that comes when you know in your heart it's not going to ever be the same again, but you don't know how you're going to survive if it's not. I don't have to explain to you silence. I don't have to explain the inability to sleep. I don't have to explain loneliness. It's impossibly painful. I don't have to explain the anguish of finality, the feeling of being physically torn apart. You know, the Bible says, what God hath joined together, let not man tear apart, rend asunder. It is an actual tearing, and it felt very physical to me when it happened. I don't have to explain to you what it feels like to lose a spouse. And so there's a lot of there's a lot of things I don't have to talk to you about. You understand already. And there's been many people that have cared for us so well. Our family, they've cared for us so well. But they don't understand. And it's not their fault. I don't blame them for that. They want to understand, and so I try to explain some of the feelings I have. And I've had some men that have sat with me and listened so well. And yet I know down inside they don't really quite get it. This group does. So I don't have to explain what it feels like to lose my wife. Let's turn to Isaiah 40. A couple verses there. Isaiah 40, verses 6 through 8. The voice said, "Cry." And he said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever." This verse isn't necessarily a commentary on death as such, but there's a strong reference to our own mortality. Being compared to grass doesn't necessarily make you feel strong, does it? Grass grows quickly, and it dies quickly. It dies easily, especially when it doesn't get water, or some days when it gets too much. So here we are, as human beings, being compared to grass. And you realize that death is not a surprise. It's not a surprise for any of us. It shouldn't be a surprise for a Christian, but the reality is it's not a surprise for anyone. And yet it's so difficult. Why is death so difficult to face? Since we kind of knew it was coming anyway. You know, the atheists, when you ask an atheist, what happens when you die? They'll tell you something like this. Well, what were you before you were born? That's kind of their answer. Well, that's kind of a good answer, isn't it? What were you before you were born? Well, you were nothing, right? And so the atheists say, well, when I die, I'll be whatever I was before I was born. And yet there's, within those circles, a lot of fear, still a lot of questions, a lot of wrestlings. That's a question that doesn't go away. What happens when I die? It's not an easy question. It's not a fun question to wrestle with, because unless we're just complete fools, we know that our death is imminent. Anyone who claims immunity to his impending death is considered a fool, and we know that. You don't have to be a Christian to recognize that your death, your time is coming. No one has been able to beat that yet, except for the stories we have in Scripture of a couple men. So why is it so difficult? And I think many of us have experienced the sting of death even before our spouse passed away. I lost a good friend and brother in the church, a neighbor. in a vehicle accident, and I was on site soon after the accident happened. He was still sitting behind the wheel, burned, and he was gone. His daughter died in the same accident. I've lost grandparents. I've lost friends, coworkers. I lost my father-in-law. Those are all huge losses. We experience loss at other levels too. We lose limbs. We lose mental acuity sometimes. Loss of possessions, loss of function. Loss is almost always bad, right? Especially if it's not reversible. It's an end to something we appreciated. It's an end to something we enjoyed, counted on, and loved. But losing our spouse is arguably the most heartrending loss of all. For me, like I said, it was almost physical pain, and I'm sure many of you can identify with that. Ecclesiastes, I'm going to read a verse from there. Ecclesiastes 3:11, I think maybe gives us a little bit of a picture why death hurts so much, when the reality is we should see it coming and we should be ready for it, right? It's inevitable. So why is it so difficult? Ecclesiastes 3:11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. He hath also set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. The ESV says, he hath set eternity in their hearts. And that the idea of eternity, when I read that verse, it makes me think that I'm made for something bigger. There's a realization in my heart that I'm created for something more than this. And I don't think that goes away. And I think as a Christian, we can follow that. We can follow that feeling. We should follow that feeling. What is it that God really, really wants for us? What are we created for? We were created for something different. And so when loss strikes us so deeply and it hurts so bad, there's something in us that is recoiling. And sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's desperation, the grand total of emotions. They're not fun emotions at all. But I think that's leading us to something bigger and a realization there's something bigger in our that we're made for. And I think it's going to push us towards that, or it can. As humans, we try to find reason and meaning. We try to make sense of things. I don't know if you find yourself there, but I desperately tried to make sense of things. I would have, when Rachel, she had an autopsy because it was a traffic accident and they were afraid it would end up in court. And so because of that, they needed to do an autopsy before they would release her. And there was a part of me was hoping that they would find her full of cancer. Because I wanted a reason. I still don't have a reason. And as humans, we try to make sense of things. We feel out of control when things don't make sense. Job's friends did this. They sat with him for a week, which is probably the best thing they did, and not say anything. And then they started talking. And they tried to come up with reasons. Job, here's what's going on. And then the other friend, well, Job, actually, this is probably what's going on. And just listen to me, Job, because I think I really understand what's going on. And really what they came up with is some really poor theology. And the fact of the matter is, if that's what we're going to go after, sometimes we're going to end up with some pretty bad conclusions as well. We're going to end up where Job's friends did. Some bad theology. And I think that journey of trying to find a reason can also keep us from just experiencing grief the way it's meant to be experienced. Let's not try to rationalize or somehow make it okay, because it's broken. It's wrong. What you're experiencing, the pain you feel, it's like when you're cut. You feel pain because you need to do something about that cut. There's something wrong with your body. or maybe you have appendicitis and you feel pain. The reason you feel pain is because there's something wrong. And when we feel grief, there is something wrong. Something's broken, and it's a result of sin. And it hurts like crazy, and we don't do ourselves any favor by minimizing that. At camp, we work a lot with boys who have been in very difficult situations, have been through a lot of pain themselves, and they try to ignore it in a lot of different ways. One of our goals is to help a boy realize that the pain he's feeling is okay. Even though the world is telling him that it's okay that dad ran off with the secretary and he just kind of needs to be okay with that. And yet he's feeling pain inside. And he's feeling pain for a reason. It's because it's wrong. And it's because it hurts. And he doesn't need somebody to tell him that it doesn't hurt or that somehow it's going to be okay. Because it's not okay. And so I think there's a part of this that it's okay for us to say, it's broken. We live in a broken world. It's wrong. It's a result of sin. And we're gonna grieve it. And we're going to cry. And we're going to feel it. And trying to rationalize it and come up with a reason sometimes minimizes that or short-circuit the grieving process. We can then allow the devastation of loss to make us angry and bitter, to shut out the cries of our heart, or we can allow it to move us with great desire to know what it is that we're actually missing. What is it that we're made for? Adam and Eve saw it. They felt it. They felt perfection in the garden. I think that's where we're headed. I really do believe that. And while we're here, we're going to continue facing the sting of sin. It can become a journey of hope when we embrace the journey. We must choose our path, and we must simply remember that our choices carry consequences as well. What we choose to do with our pain does carry consequences. Each of us has a story, and I don't think we do well to compare stories and say, well, my loss is worse than yours, or your loss is worse than mine. Loss is loss, as we talked about, and it strikes each one of us at our core. And I think we do well to listen to each other in our stories, to talk about it, and hopefully together we can encourage each other to move on the path of hope. Rachel was killed instantly. Some of you had to watch your spouse suffer for years. I don't know which I would want. And I'm glad I didn't have to decide. There's times when I wish I would have had time. I wished I would have had even a day. I wished I would have had 6 months. But then I also realized that I wouldn't have wanted to watch my wife suffer. And then I'm grateful that it was quick. So it's hard to compare. And thankfully, we're not God. I'll talk just briefly about Rachel's accident and then just our journey as a family beyond that. And yeah, I give this story, and I would enjoy hearing some of your stories as well, but I'll try to move through this quickly. But it was about 3.5 years ago. She was taking the children to piano lessons. And pulled into the driveway, got out of the vehicle, and right at that moment there was a two-car accident on the road just a few feet away from her, probably about 10 feet away, or well, at that point maybe 20 feet away, but the vehicle immediately spun out of control and hit Rachel, and they believe probably killed her instantly. We had just started piano lessons there. We knew that the piano teacher was potentially moving. They had their house for sale, But we decided to go ahead and do the lessons anyway, and when they moved, then we'd just find another teacher. The irony was that the accident was caused by the realtor who was stopping for a showing that day. The children were all there. Two of them were still in the vehicle. Two of them had got out. The two oldest had already got out of the vehicle. It seemed like such a violent, unceremonious way for her to die. But one of her cousins reminded me at the funeral in Iowa. We had two funerals, one in Pennsylvania with a viewing and one in Iowa with a viewing as well. One of her cousins reminded me that when she was about 18, they were in discussion somewhere, and they were talking about a tragic accident that had happened, and it happened very quickly. And Rachel had said, "Well, isn't that the way you'd want to go, quick?" And maybe she got her wish. It took a while for the children to realize what had happened. There was a lot of yelling and screaming and cursing on the scene. The driver of the Jeep is now upside down in the middle of the road, and his children are belted in, hanging in their seat belts, yelling. He's back up the road, yelling at the driver of the vehicle that caused the accident, cursing her out, completely ignoring his own children. My children see a lady laying beside the road, and they thought it was the Jeep driver's wife, and so they weren't sure what to do. It took them a little bit. It took them a little time to realize it was Mom. They couldn't do anything about it. I know my youngest screamed. My oldest son was doing his best to comfort the driver of the vehicle that had caused the accident. And my daughter was probably doing the best, just keeping her head about her, and immediately went to find a phone to try to call Dad. I was about 20 minutes away, and I went to the children. I didn't know the outcome. The children didn't know the outcome. There was people gathered around pretty quickly. The ambulance came, and I came to the scene of the accident. By then, Rachel had been transported, and they took her into the hospital, even though she was already gone. I prayed with the children, and then I got back in the truck and headed for the hospital along with a friend. On the way, I called the hospital because they were talking about they actually had brought in Life Flight. And so I called the hospital trying to figure out where I should go. And that's when the ER doc on duty told me that she was gone. It's very, if you're here and you've been in a traumatic, or your spouse went through traumatic death, then I don't have to explain the feelings. But just a complete shock and just unbelief. Just could not understand what God was doing. And I just remember, I switched places with my friend. He drove. I said, "I can't drive." And just talking out loud and crying out to God, and just, I could not understand. I guess I kind of felt immune a little bit because of my special needs son. And maybe I thought that God would never take Rachel because I had Hans. Hans was kind of our cross to bear together. And it's not like I ever challenged God, but I just didn't think it would happen. I didn't think he could do that. But that's what happened. And so there's just a complete disbelief. A lot of exhaustion in the next several days. Brain's running wide open, but I can't sleep. There's a lot to think about, a lot to plan. partly because there was two different funerals. I wanted to bury her in Iowa, which was home. In the days and weeks following the accident, I had a very strong sense that I was going to be walking into an intense darkness, and very likely would walk it alone. And that didn't mean I didn't have good, caring people around me. I did. I had so many people coming in, helping with my family, men who would sit and listen, men who were texting me, caring for me in so many ways. They were doing everything they could. And yet, there was a distinct feeling that there was a darkness I was going to be walking into that no one could walk with me. Maybe you felt that. And the question was, if I go there, if I allow myself to go into that darkness, is Jesus going to meet me there? Will he catch me? It's a more intense darkness than I've ever faced before. In his book, A Grace Disguised, Jerry Sitzer uses the analogy of running from the setting sun, or running toward the setting sun in a desperate attempt to get away from the impending darkness. The darkness was coming, and he was running, and he couldn't outrun the darkness. So he collapsed with exhaustion, realizing that the darkness is going to overtake him. Later, in talking with his sister, just coming to a realization that the quickest way out of the darkness is back towards the darkness. And I think the analogy is very true as we quit trying to run from the darkness, but instead embrace it, face it, and trust and hope that Jesus is going to meet us there. So hard. I remember one day just collapsing to my knees, just completely overwhelmed by Hans's needs and Caitlin's needs, my youngest, all at once. My children didn't know what to do with that. But it's just the way I felt. I understand so well, or I heard many times of people turning to alcohol and drugs and other illicit pleasures just as pain deadeners. I didn't really understand that. I thought, why would you go destroy yourself after something terrible has happened? I think I understand it better now, because there's a sense that unless something gives, I'm not going to survive. I can't do this on my own. And I'm going to have some relief. I think for the Christian, that is Jesus. That's where we turn. If you don't have Jesus, then drugs and alcohol start making a lot more sense. I didn't really get that before, but I think now I have more sympathy for people that go that route. Not that it makes it right, but it makes sense. So I struggled a lot with God during those nights. A lot of nights I spent in my chair after the children were in bed, crying, writing, wrestling. Some of it was spent texting my family. Some of it was journaling, asking God a lot of questions. All my ideas about God's role in suffering, they were being tried pretty hard. Cute theology doesn't survive very well in the tortured questions of grief. So I had a lot of questions like, did God cause the accident? Did he simply allow it? Was this orchestrated? Was this his will? If he could have stopped it, why didn't he? Was there a plan, or was this just a tragedy and I'm a victim of it? Was it just a random event with my family as victims? People made comments like, God will bring beauty out of this. I didn't necessarily believe that. I felt like anything could happen. Nothing felt safe anymore. I thought I knew how things should work. But all of a sudden, nothing was safe. I didn't know what I was going to lose next. I wanted to believe that. I wanted to trust. The questions of, does God know how much I can handle? But then, more terrifying than did God cause it, and being angry at God, was the idea that maybe God didn't have anything to do with it at all. And that was terrifying. And I'm just speaking of my wrestlings early on, and the theology, you know, not that solid. I agree, I understand. But theology kind of goes out the window in the moments of crisis, and I think we have to wrestle with God on these things. There were things that I struggled with feeling like I wasn't good enough for her, and that's why God took her. Maybe there was big questions she was still dealing with that I hadn't been able to answer. I struggled with the idea of heaven. People would say she's enjoying the beauties of heaven. No more pain. All's perfect. And I wanted to say, I didn't think it was so bad here. I thought we were doing okay. She wasn't hurting. She wasn't suffering. So heaven didn't have a lot of warm, fuzzy feelings for me. In fact, I got a little jealous sometimes. I struggled with just the finality. I knew heaven was a place where I wanted to go. I knew I'd see her someday. That I didn't really doubt that. But I didn't know, you know, would we be a couple in heaven? And, you know, she'd probably just be just as happy to see all the other guys as me when I showed up. Because you're not given in marriage anymore, right? It made me mad. I don't know if that ever made you mad, but it made me mad. So I'm just exposing myself here. And a lot of that is just, I don't understand what heaven's going to look like completely. There's a lot we don't understand. We get pictures. And those pictures are beautiful. But all of a sudden, I had a lot more questions than I had answers. I felt robbed. I felt robbed of my time with her. Because of Hans's special needs and our young family, we had spent a lot of time just caring for our family. Couldn't get away very well. So other couples would go on walks or go out to eat or go out for coffee. And that was just something we couldn't do without a babysitter. Didn't have grandparents close by. And so we just didn't do that very often. And I remember telling her, just looking forward, and we were right on the cusp of that, where the older children were able to stay with Hans, with Caitlin. One evening, just probably a couple months before the accident, she and I walked down the mountain and picked up a four-wheeler that had run out of gas. And I just remember telling her, you know, we're gonna be able to do this some more before too long, because the children are old enough that they can take care of each other and take care of the young ones. So looking forward to that. And it felt like I never got it. So I had strong feelings about that. I felt picked on. Why me? I have a lot on my plate already. What's God up to? And that big question again, is God involved at all? So that's the raw stuff and that I felt. And some of the realizations that I came to during that time, even though I had a lot of hard questions, I had a strong sense that I didn't want to be God. I don't know if you can identify with that or not, but when your mind goes around and around trying to figure out how this could be or should have been, but you realize you don't want to be God. So I can tell God that it was the wrong time to take my wife. Well, then if I would have that right to tell him that, at what point am I going to tell him that it is okay to take my wife? At 60, 70? I'm not going to like it very well then either. And so I wrestled with if I'm going to try to tell God what's okay or what's not okay, there's a lot of other areas that I'm going to have to play God in too that I don't want to. And the idea of being the God of my own life held no appeal whatsoever. And so in my big questions, I think I was able to still leave God where he belonged, and that was as God. And in my wrestlings, poor theology, good theology, whatever it was, I wanted him to be God. And that hasn't really changed. I want him to be there. I'm happy that he's there. I don't understand everything that he's doing, but I'm content with him being God, and I have reached the point where I believe I don't have to have answers either. Some of the things he did for me, he gave me a sense of peace at night. I would lie awake for hours, but I didn't dread going to bed. I didn't dread the night. I didn't dread the evenings in my big blue chair, crying, wrestling with God, writing. I didn't dread that. I think that was a gift. I think that was his grace. When I did go to bed and I'd wake up at 2 in the morning and be awake the rest of the night, I didn't dread it. Somehow I got rest. I don't know how, but I did. And I think that was the grace of God. He also helped me recognize the gift that Rachel was. I relived the moment then she said yes to start dating. I relived, you know, where I was when I got that message from her. And just the sheer joy, exhilaration. And that day, the gift. It was a gift. I was feeling robbed on November 10, 2020. But on the day she said yes, that was a gift. So would I reject that gift, knowing what I do now? Would I have wished that she would say no to a proposal for courtship just because I know that she's going to be gone in 19 years? No, not at all. Not a chance. I would not trade those 19 years, even knowing what I've had to go through, what my family's had to go through, because of the gift that she was to me and to my family. So I could begin to thank God even in the middle of grief, even in the middle of deep, deep loss. There's another book that I read. I mentioned Jerry Sitzer's book, A Grace Disguised. I don't know if you've read that. I highly recommend it. There's another book that had nothing to do with death or the sort of death that I was facing, and it's called Killing Christians, and it's about Muslims who are dying for their faith. And the book was kind of a surprise. I'm not sure why I got it, but I read it. It was one of the few books. I could hardly read my Bible. I could read the Psalms. I could identify with Titus when he said he could read the Psalms. But there was so much of the Bible I almost could not read for the first couple months. But Jerry Sitzer's book and the book Killing Christians I could read. And Killing Christians had multiple stories of Christians who lost their life for the sake of the gospel, including one story of a young couple, 2 years married, that one morning he woke up feeling strongly that was the day he was going to meet Jesus. He told his wife, of course she didn't want to see him leave the house, but he said, no, it's okay. He felt strongly that he needed to go back and do what he was doing, realizing that it might be his last. And so they prayed together, drank coffee together, and kind of got ready for it. And then he left the house, and true to his intuition, he was killed that day. And his wife became a widow. And I read that, and it just, and that story and many others, the realization that I'm not the only one that suffers. I needed that perspective. There are people that willfully suffer, people that have willfully lost their loved ones for the cause of Christ. There's something about a tragedy that, like my family experienced, that makes one feel very, like the world kind of everything revolves around them, or there's nobody else that is suffering like this today or this week. There's that tendency to feel that way. It's not true. It's not true. There is suffering everywhere. And I needed that perspective, and I found it in that book. I think that book was a gift to me from our Father as well. I remember my dad-in-law calling numerous times. I think he called maybe about once a week after the accident, until he too succumbed to pancreatic cancer. But the question of, was I good enough, was a very difficult question for me, because I don't know where that came from, but I remember her dad speaking into that in such a powerful way and telling me that, he said, "You're the best thing that's happened to her besides Jesus." That has to be hard for a dad to say. That's a powerful thing for a dad to say. But I think he was Jesus to me during those times. And there was so much silence after he died. Excuse me. So the role of community in my grief, there's some things I've learned about grieving that I didn't know before. We had so much given to us. Cards, texts, money gifts. Money seemed, it meant less to me than it ever had. But it was so helpful. I didn't like thrift store shopping. My wife did. She liked Goodwill. I didn't. I didn't have time for going down the racks trying to find a good pair of pants for Hans or finding a jacket. And so when people gave, I was able to just go buy the things we needed, buy the shoes, buy things, whatever it was. The community, the church, friends helped so much during that time. But one thing I learned, and I'm still learning, so there's words can't express what we feel when we lose a loved one like that. There, you can't put a word on it, or I couldn't. One of the most powerful things that people did for me was just come and hold me, give me a hug, and not say anything. And they would apologize because they didn't have anything to say. I was perfectly fine with that. And I just think there's a lot of wisdom for this group, as we know people that suffer have no words. And we're not wise to come with many words. I think there's a lot of wisdom in just coming and bringing our presence to someone who's grieving. I experienced that as something that I'm trying to learn and also offer to other people. The Christian community truly is the hands and feet of Jesus. The camp staff and the board, they were very gracious with me in working. They allowed flexibility in hours, a lot of time to process. It was a safe place to struggle. People wondered if I would leave camp because of not having a wife anymore. But the reality is my work was the only thing that was normal anymore. And so I wanted to stay there, and I'm still there. And I'm very appreciative of the camp and staff. After the accident, we were worried about trauma for the children. They were all there. There was a lot of blood, chaos, screaming, yelling, cursing. All the things that it takes to create trauma, long-term trauma, really, and the stuff that nightmares is made of. A couple at camp specifically prayed with our children. I think it was the second night. We just got together with them and prayed specifically about what they had seen. Because they had seen a lot. And it was probably within the week, I think a few days later, that my children were coming to me saying, "Dad, the pictures, they're going away." I think that was the grace of God as well. Those images could have been seared in their brains. As far as I know, they didn't have nightmares. They were sleeping well within the first day or two, a lot better than I was. God extended so much grace to our children, to my children, in that. We've had really good help. We've had several nannies that have joined us. The first one was with us for 2.5 years, and she came from Iowa. She was a CNA. She stepped right in and began to just help with the things that needed done. After 2.5 years, there was an observant supervisor that found her, and so she got married, and we started talking about, well, who are we going to get to help with the special needs son? My children still young. And talking to a friend and just asking her about it, and she said, I know who you need to talk to. And with very, very small amount of work on our part, we soon had another nanny coming, and she's still with us and is doing excellent. And I'm so grateful for the way God has cared for my family through those girls. My children love them, and they've done so much just to make life normal again. Jesus hasn't answered all my questions. I don't really expect him to, like I said, but he's meeting our needs. And I remember standing in the back there quite a few years ago. I was at the handicap seminar, and a brother was telling me, he said, you can't worry about the future with a handicapped child. He said, you have to look back and say, God is taking care of us. That's the only way you survive. And I think those words are so true, and they apply in this situation as well. Turn to Ecclesiastes 7. Ecclesiastes 7. I want to talk just a little bit about hope. Verse 1 through 4. A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. If you read these verses, they are so counterintuitive to the American way of thinking about life. Sorrow is better than laughter? That makes no sense. Why? The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. The day of death better than the day of our birth? But I think as we open ourselves up to these things, there's an enlarging of the heart that begins to happen. So we can run from our grief and from our pain, and we begin to shut off a lot of things. On the surface, we shut off each other. If I'm gonna run from feeling things, I'm probably not gonna want to talk to you very much about anything that goes too deep either. So I begin to cut off the people around me, the people that want to care. But one of the surprising things that I've discovered is that joy and grief could coexist. I didn't think that could happen. I didn't think that I would ever experience joy again. I didn't think I could ever sing again. Rachel and I enjoyed singing together. We sang some as a family. We were just starting to sing in four parts. She and I had sung together at numerous weddings when we were younger. So singing was important to us, and I just didn't think I could again. I didn't think it'd be possible. I didn't think that joy and grief could coexist, but they can. And it seems that as we have allowed ourselves to feel and experience some of the deep, deep hurt that has gone along with this, we've also experienced some real joy and some real gifts from the Father and also from His people. And we've experienced other people in ways that I don't think we would have before. So I think as we allow ourselves to feel grief, we also increase our capacity for joy. And I wonder if that's not what it's talking about when it says sorrow is better than laughter. For by sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. I don't think I would wish sorrow on someone, but I would wish that their heart can be enlarged. And if suffering is the way that our heart can be enlarged, then I think we're wise to embrace it at whatever level it comes to us. Not because it's something we want or something we enjoy, but because of what God can do with it. When I did some training at camp on trauma, not because of the accident, but because of my work at camp. And I wish I'd know who to attribute this quote to, but it was in the training. It says, those mourners who draw on spiritual coping strategies and who suffer violent death, and I think we could put other types of death in here as well, but it was talking specifically about violent death. Those mourners who draw on spiritual coping strategies and who suffer violent death bereavement are most likely to report growth in compassion, strength, a sense of possibility, and appreciation of life in the long-term wake of loss. And that's kind of loaded, but I think it confirms what Ecclesiastes 7 is saying, that as we allow ourselves to grieve and sorrow, our hearts are actually enlarged. And I like where it says it increases the appreciation of life. So it truly appears that whether tragedy and grief destroy us or not, it largely comes down to our choices. We can allow it to make us isolated and angry, or we can allow it to move us closer to our Heavenly Father and towards His people. So there's things that have brought my family joy and things that we've done. We've continued to enjoy music. We went to Shenandoah Music Camp last summer. These are things that they're hard for me to do, but they bring a lot of joy to the children. And when I see them being normal and enjoying life, then it helps me as well. So I do it, and then I'm glad that we did. We went to music camp. We talk about Rachel all the time. We love to talk about her, and the good and the bad. The dumb things she did, because she did some dumb things, as we all do, and the beautiful things that she did, that she brought to our family. And we can talk about them whenever, however, and sometimes it brings tears. A lot of times it brings laughter, and it's fun. And we like to talk about Mom. It's not an off subject, and I'm very grateful for that. In line with the music too, both of our nannies have really enjoyed music, and they've continued that tradition with the children. That feels like a gift from God. We enjoyed going camping. We got a horse, and we've gone horseback riding in the Dolly Sods. Calvin Schrock is here tonight. So grateful to see him. But he has no idea how much his horseback riding escapades in the Dolly Sods have done for my daughter. And just something that she and I have enjoyed immensely together. And some really precious memories of things that I wanted to go to the Dolly Sods sometime with Rachel, never got to. It's just fun to go up there with my daughter horseback riding. We went to Alaska because that was something that I was hoping to do with Rachel, maybe when for our 20th wedding anniversary. It was hard. It's not necessarily that much fun sleeping in a hotel in the same bed as your son, when you know you had dreams of otherwise on a second honeymoon trip. But we had a good time. And we enjoyed Alaska a lot. We enjoyed each other a lot. My children would say that our life is full. And I think it's because of the gift of God and the gift of healing, the gift of redemption, the way He redeems even broken things. We wouldn't want it this way, but the reality is it's what we have. And God has brought so many beautiful things to us. Coming back around to some of my feelings about heaven, I do feel differently now, lest you were concerned. I'm looking forward to going to heaven sometime. and I have a lot greater peace about her being there. I don't know what meeting her there is going to be like. I don't understand all those things yet, and I'm okay with that. It's taken some time, but I'm content with the idea of her being there and me being here. I find a lot of joy in taking care of my children and also working with the boys at camp. Paul, my dad-in-law, talked about heaven being more like earth than we think it is. So in Revelation, it talks about the new heaven coming down. It talks about the new Jerusalem coming down and there being a new heaven and a new earth. And it sounds to me, I used to think about, you know, going up into the sky and being up there and heaven was up there somewhere. And I'm not saying I understand it completely, but the picture I get more and more is that this earth is going to be completely destroyed and remade. And the new Jerusalem, the beautiful city, is going to show up here. And I don't know if that's accurate or not, but there's something about the idea of heaven being a little more like earth than I thought it was going to be, but perfect. Just perfect and beautiful. No pain. And so I think about my interactions with Rachel someday, and I look forward to them because even though we loved each other, our relationship was imperfect because we lived in an imperfect world. But someday that relationship is going to be perfect. And the relationships that we have with each other are going to be perfect. And I so look forward to that. The conversations at our house are different than they used to be. And I think in a good way. And we look forward to heaven. But we are enjoying life. And I think my challenge is to continue allowing the pain of life to push me in the direction of hope and not of bitterness and anger. There's plenty of things in this world to become angry at. There's plenty of things to become bitter at if we want to. But let's allow that nudge, that feeling of something's wrong, let's allow it to push us towards hope, towards the reality of what we were made for. Let's allow him to push us towards our Heavenly Father and the glory of eternity. So God bless each one of you. I look forward to the weekend and hearing your stories and sharing together. I've been encouraged by being here other times, and I look forward to what God has for us this weekend as well. God bless.